passages from literature is one of the great sources of enjoyment that we can have. But these days, we think that memorizing anything is just a way of loading up your mind with unnecessary equipment. And yet, that's not true. Memorizing is not for the purpose of using it for something useful, purposeful, but it is more as a source of play. Memorizing text, memorizing poetry is a way of playing in your mind with well-ordered, well-structured ideas. And some people carry with them their favorite words and poems or baseball statistics written on pieces of paper so that when they want to look at it, they can take it out. And that's how you start. You first write things down that impress you, that please you, that you want to remember. And then eventually you can start remembering them. And that is the beginning of playing with memories and enjoying the use of memories. But from there, one can move on to much more systematic ways. For instance, many people like to, or I should say probably all people, like to remember their own family roots, their history, the family tree, where they came from. And this, for many people, is a tremendous source of enjoyment. They go out and try to trace back who they are related to, where they come from, create a kind of a family tree. And many people become historians of their family. They not only trace the relatives, the ancestors, but also the events, what happened to them, where they came from, what they did. And there's no reason that only professional historians should know about the past. It's something that all of us can be concerned with and can derive enjoyment from. And at first, of course, we may be interested in the history of our own family, of our own parents, grandparents. But then it becomes interesting to understand the history of the community in which you live, or the ethnic group to which you belong, or perhaps the history of your profession, or the hobbies that you work with. So this looking back into the past enriches the present and gives meaning to the future in a way that can be very satisfying and enjoyable as you do it. So the use of memory, both in terms of favorite ideas, favorite verses, and also in terms of what happened in the past and how it relates to you now, is one important source of flow.
Flow and the use of language.
One of the great potentialities of the mind is the ability to use language. We have gotten used to the idea that speaking and communicating is simply in order to pass information back and forth. But actually, the amazing thing about words and language is how much fun they can be when we start playing with them. Our children, for instance, had hours and hours of fun, and we all had fun around the dinner table when we started using puns and plays on words when they were small, pretending to misunderstand what they were saying when the word had double meaning. For instance, having your grandmother for dinner could mean either inviting her or having her cook for a dinner, and the children at first were very puzzled by that, but, you know, they catch on and they realize that by moving words around, by giving them different meanings, you can create a different reality in your mind. You can imagine that things are happening which are not exactly the way they are. And so a routine, everyday type of life can be changed by the use of words. After a while, you begin to play with words more systematically, for instance, using crossword puzzles, which are actually a very good way, for instance, to increase one's vocabulary. One thing that you find with successful executives, for instance, is that the breadth of vocabulary is one of the things that distinguishes them most from people at the same level who do not advance in a company or a corporation. So the ability to use words becomes an important tool later on in life. And unless children learn how to use words early, and unless you practice that all through your life, the ability to use words as tools for both reflecting reality and changing reality Unless you do that, you are going to be handicapped and you are going to lose a great opportunity for enjoying this facility that the mind provides, the use of language as a way of playing, as a way of changing reality. Of course, after playing with words like with riddles and puzzles, you can use words in a more aesthetic, in a more creative way, and that is by writing down your ideas as stories or even as poems. It has been shown, for instance, that older people who never wrote really in their lives anything except perhaps checks, once they are in their 60s, 70s and their life becomes constricted, they can learn to write poems, and that enlarges the quality of their lives tremendously. Poetry is not just for poets, it's a way for us to use words to describe what we actually feel, what is happening to us.
Flow and games.
Then the mind can be used for a variety of games, learning rules, learning ways to operate mentally according to the rules. We all know some of these games, for instance, playing card games, playing chess, playing checkers. All of these are good ways to experience the ability of the mind to overcome challenges. The challenges may be your competitors you are playing against. But there are games that you can invent where the rules are known only to you. For instance, one of my friends, a famous physicist, who gets very bored when he has to sit in boring lectures, which happens quite a lot when you are in academia. Instead of feeling bored and feeling sorry for himself, he developed a strategy of playing with his fingers as if he were playing the piano, and by alternating beating with his thumb and then the middle finger, the index and the ring finger, then the middle finger and the pinky, and doing this in about 25 different ways to form a pattern, he can actually do this for about over 3,000 different combinations without stopping and without repeating the same pattern. And this seems like a fairly silly way to spend time, but actually he is able to lift the level of attention and concentration that otherwise would be diffused by his boredom by doing this activity. So playing games like chess, bridge, or inventing your own rules for paying attention is one way to avoid the obstacles to psychic harmony, to the ordering of consciousness, which boredom and anxiety usually provide. But if you are tired of playing games and you want to do something more constructive with your mind, there is nothing wrong with venturing into areas like science and medicine. This may seem strange for someone who perhaps doesn't have a higher degree or didn't even finish college, but there is no reason why one could not use one's mind in a systematic way, in a useful way, even if one lacks a degree or a diploma.
Flow and science.
Some of the greatest scientists in the past did not have degrees, were not trained, and were not certified in the scientific branch in which they studied. Some of the great physicists and discoverers of electricity, like Volta, were trained in medicine, and then they switched to physics. Galileo was trained originally also in law and then became the initiator of physics. People have laboratories in their basements. They can experiment, they can build things, they can do sometimes truly amazing achievements by spending energy, focusing attention on the issues that interest them. But of course you have to be interested. You have to develop at least some curiosity and interest in a part of reality. And that is one of the gifts of a complex consciousness, the ability to be open to interest, to the openness to new ideas, to new sensations, to aspects of reality that are interesting and puzzling.
flow, and the study of wisdom.
Another branch of activity for the mind is the study of ancient wisdom, the philosophies, the religions of older times that in different cultures or in our own culture people have struggled to assemble, struggled to use to make our lives more understandable, more clear, to make the relation among people more fruitful, more easy. So again, you find people who, without training, without being officially recognized as philosophers or scholars, people still are able to glean the wisdom, to assemble the knowledge by reading, by talking, by joining clubs and discussion clubs of books and ideas, taking evening courses, going to lectures. A whole world of information, of important wisdom opens up if you take seriously the challenge that your mind is exposed to in this complex world in which we live. In other words, the whole point is that the mind is an organ that has incredible potential. You may wonder in what way studying philosophy or religion contributes to flow, or what good is it unless you do it at a professional level. Well, anybody who starts delving into these knowledge that the past has accumulated begins to feel the exhilaration, the enjoyment that a challenge to the mind can provide. It was Plato who 25 centuries ago said that nothing is as enjoyable as using your mind in studying philosophy. And in a way, that is true, especially if you are not forced to do it, when you do it spontaneously because you are interested on your own. What happens when you study the wisdom of older times is the same as what happens to the mind when you focus on a game or on a puzzle or on a poem. In other words, you begin to see a goal as you start reading. The goal is to understand what the author is trying to talk about. And usually the author starts out by talking about some important topic, like how do we know what is good and bad? How do we know whether things exist? How do we know what is beautiful? These are the topics that philosophers have been struggling to understand for a long time, and these are the goals of the particular essay or book that you are going to read. So once you are aware of what the goal is, you follow sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, the argument of the author, and each paragraph is going to present you with a challenge, with a way of thinking about the subject that you have never thought before. And the skill that you have to use is to try to decode, try to understand what the author is presenting you. What is the challenge that is being put in front of you by the author? This activity, this process of setting goals, taking on the challenge of the writer, developing the skill to meet the challenge, produces the same form of concentration and loss of self and order in consciousness that other types of flow activities provide. And you are going to experience the enjoyment of this unified, focused state of mind while you are doing the activity. And then, if the activity is studying philosophy, religion, the wisdom of the ancients, at the end of it, not only will you have experienced flow, but you will have added a small amount of important knowledge to your life. One very moving example of what playing with the contents of the mind can do is a story that I heard from a man I interviewed a few years ago. His name is Gyorgy Faludy. He's a poet who has translated thousands of poems from every language known to man, practically, into Hungarian. And he has also written many poems of his own, several books, actually, of poems. But the most interesting work he did was while he was in a prison camp, where he was put by the communists for having criticized Stalin and the communist regime. So he was put in this camp where actually a majority of the people would eventually die because the conditions were so cruel and inhumane. People had to work year-round without adequate clothing and food, being persecuted by the guards, beaten up if they didn't obey immediately. In other words, it was the worst of the nightmares of dictatorial communist society. What was so moving was the fact that throughout this nightmare situation, Faludi kept writing poems. But writing is not the right word, because he didn't have pencil, paper, or anything to write with. So he composed his poems line at a time and memorized it. And when he had 9, 10 lines memorized, he would teach it to one or two of his prison inmate or camp inmate, who was very glad to learn the poem, because by learning the poem, they had something inside their mind that was truly theirs, that was beautiful, that could not be taken away from them by the guards. Over and over, he taught these poems, pieces of poems, to hundreds of inmates, so he felt that if he were to die, like so many others did, at least these verses that were true descriptions of what people in those conditions felt would not be lost. He had a way of saving them for posterity. One touching part of this was that as some of the inmates were freed after the regime started to soften up somewhat, when some of these people went back to Budapest where the poet's wife lived, they would go to her and recite parts of a long poem that he wrote to his wife. The memory of his wife was part of what kept him sane during these years of deprivation. And so they would recite a line here, a line there, all that they had memorized, and they would tell her, well, this is the part I know, but in 2 or 3 weeks there is this other guy who's coming out, and he will be able to tell you the rest. And so slowly, these poems that were memorized were put together again, were written down, and they were published. And now they are some of the most true and devastating testimonials to the brutality of man on the one hand, but they are also testimonials to the power of the mind to overcome conditions of terrible deprivation by creating something beautiful out of the tragic conditions which sometimes are the lot of our life. Just as the body makes possible an enormous variety of enjoyable physical activities, the mind unlocks an entire world of possibilities for flow. Most of us, however, feel that we are too busy, too harassed, too tired to use our mind beyond what is necessary. We think of the mind as a problem-solving tool to be used at work and to deal with emergencies. As soon as we get home, however, we prefer to disconnect our minds and think as little as possible. We feel that we deserve our rest and believe that turning into couch potatoes will make us feel relaxed and happy. Unfortunately, mindless relaxation is not very restful, and it certainly does not lead to mental or physical growth in complexity. If we stop thinking of the mind as simply a problem-solving tool and think of it instead as an organ of enjoyment, we shall discover a whole new world of opportunities for flow. At first, it will be hard to concentrate on the symbolic skills required for enjoying the use of the mind. It is not easy to become an amateur poet, historian, or scientist. It is important to start with simple challenges, to set manageable goals, to savor and evaluate the results of your work, to concentrate at first for short periods, then for longer and longer periods of time. Sooner or later, what you do will become easier, and before you know it, you will be taken up by the spontaneous current of thought. You will be carried away by the flow of the mind.
Listen as one woman talks about how she experiences flow at work.
To be totally absorbed in what you are doing and to enjoy it so much that you don't want to be doing anything else. I don't see how people survive if they don't experience something like that. If I went to work every day and just had to sort of wait until Miller time, just do my work and have no feeling of getting anything out of it, I'd look for something else to do.
How can you make your work life more enjoyable? The uses of flow on the job are applicable to managers, secretaries, or just about anyone else who wants to develop their potential for happiness.
Flow is not something that happens only in free time, when you have nothing better to do. The ideal and natural way of things is one where we enjoy equally every aspect of life, work and play, obligations and leisure. One of the biggest problems in our society is that we have divided life into work that we feel is necessary but is unpleasant, and play, which we enjoy but find basically meaningless. Our studies show that by sixth grade, children have learned to feel unhappy, bored, and weak when they're doing anything they think of as work, and to feel happy, excited, and strong when they do something they define as play. At the same time, they say that work is important for them and play is not. So we learn to be never satisfied. We either do something tedious but necessary or something pleasant but pointless. Yet, for most people, the job they do provides more opportunities for growth and enjoyment than their leisure time does. It is not too difficult to understand why this should be so. For many people at work, the challenges are higher. The goals are clearer, the feedback more consistent than they usually are in free time. Therefore, you may be happier when working than you are at home. A person who has developed an autotelic personality enjoys work and play equally and finds meaning in both. Some jobs are almost created in order to make flow possible. For instance, the highly professional jobs such as being a surgeon, being a lawyer, being a computer programmer provides an almost infinite number of skills and challenges, and one can operate within those jobs having the same amount of flow as one would have being an artist or being an athlete. So there are many jobs that provide flow almost naturally. For instance, one of the professions we studied is that of surgeons. Surgeons are supposed to be so enamored of their job that many of them are unable to take vacations, and if their wives finally take them down to the Caribbean or to Acapulco, after a few days on the beach, they will go and volunteer in the local hospital to do operations there, because surgery is the most exciting things they can think of. They become addicted. Many surgeons say that doing surgery is almost as addictive as being on heroin. You can't stop doing it. Some of the surgeons say their hands become trembling after a few days that for some reason they can't operate. So you become addicted to the high quality of experience, because doing surgery is activity where you have very clear goals. You know what organ you have to excise or what bones you have to reset, and everything is very clearly spelled out. And as you do the surgery, as you move second by second, you know how well you're doing. As long as there is no blood in the cavity, for instance, you know that your cut is going the way it should go. Like a tennis player who knows every second where the ball is going and where it should go, so the surgeon knows how well he's doing minute by minute. Now, this quality of tremendous focus and involvement is possible because it's one of the characteristics of the job. Now, many jobs we do not have that well-structured quality that makes us feel flow when we do it. There are many others that do, but not all. In fact, most of the office jobs we do, most of the clerical jobs, are so undefined and the goals are either very repetitive and you have to do the same thing over and over and it becomes boring, or it's not very clear what you should be doing and so you're kind of operating in a fog most of the time. Under these conditions, when the job does not provide flow on its own, then the only recourse for a person is to be able to change the job around so that there will be flow even though it's not there to begin with. So you are responsible, in a sense, if you want to enjoy what you're doing, to create your own goals, to provide your own challenges. The two things that most people complain about their jobs is that it lacks variety, that it lacks challenge. That's one. The second one is that it is difficult to get along with your boss. Either the boss doesn't respect you or gives you too much work to do or some other problem that you have with your superiors. So those are the two places one should start working at if you want to make your work more enjoyable. How do you bring more variety to the job? Well, Studs Terkel once described supermarket cashiers who have to punch in the numbers of the purchases. This was before we had this kind of electronic strips that were read automatically. So they had to punch the numbers and then crank the register, and it was a very boring, repetitive job. But the ones who enjoyed it developed their own ways of thinking about this thing differently from just having to do this routine work. For instance, one cashier thought that she was playing the piano and she was playing chords with her fingers when she punched in the numbers in the register. And by thinking of it this way, as playing the piano instead of playing the register, she could recreate in her mind the kind of sound the register would make if those were keys on a piano. She was actually more accurate than other cashiers, and she felt less alienated from her job by doing so than most others. So, again, here, what we're talking about in terms of variety, variety is partly external, it's partly given to you by the parameters of the job, by the external constraint of the job, but variety is really something that you yourself can create subjectively without changing too much of the external world. You change the way you perceive the external world. You see details, you see possibilities that are hidden to the eye of most people or to anybody except yourself. If you look, if you pay attention, you can achieve this transformation and make a job that otherwise would seem boring and have absolutely no variety, you can turn it into something that is at least varied enough to keep you going until you find a new level of challenge within that job. And usually, people who learn to enjoy their job are the ones who learn most about it, who become most skilled about it, and the ones who are seen by their superiors as having the motivation, having the initiative to be promoted, to get more challenging jobs later on. So even though the important thing is to have the internal sense of variety, there is also an external payoff that comes from approaching work this way. And the payoff is that you will be recognized as someone who is growing on the job, who is not just letting the external conditions dictate what happens, but someone who changes the situation so that he can make the work into something more than what it is. And that shows an initiative, imagination, motivation, which is what any organization looks for when they are trying to advance people within the organization. In fact, in talking to CEOs and leaders of great organizations, what I'm impressed by is how often these CEOs, especially when they are approaching retirement and they're looking for the people they want to promote to leadership within their organizations, how often what they're looking for is not necessarily somebody who is very able or very ambitious or very highly achieving individual. They are looking more for someone who is intrinsically interested in the job or in the company, someone who is not out for only his or her own personal advantage, somebody who is not using the job as a tool for achieving something personal, but someone who is so intrigued and so invested in whatever activity the firm is pursuing that is willing to work hard and is willing to think hard about ways of improving, ways of making the organization grow. So this intrinsic involvement, this enjoyment of the work for its own sake, is a signal that a person is responsible and will have the well-being of the company at heart rather than only working for personal advantage. Another obstacle to flow at work is being able to get along with other people, especially with one's superiors. And here, how to make that situation into one more flow-like requires being able to look at the interaction with one's boss, with one's peers, as a challenge which requires certain skills on your part to meet, to match. And so, again, a question becomes, what kind of goals can you set? How can you get to know better what your boss or what your coworkers want? How do you get information so that you can meet the interaction on an even foot, so that you can earn their respect and at the same time maintain your integrity by showing what you can do, by showing what your needs are, what your goals are, and respecting their goals and their needs? It's a question of communication, primarily. Almost everyone in middle management and above says that the greatest skills they need to learn is communication, and the reason they need to learn those skills is because that's what's needed in order to get along with the people who count for so much in the success of one's work life. So communication is a skill that we all need to have, and the more enmeshed in an organization or bureaucracy you are, the more you need to know that, because that's the means, the skill by which you can survive and prosper in a group of people who have divergent goals, divergent interests, and navigating in that situation is the way to be able to not only survive, but eventually to enjoy the human relations that are so important in almost every job. And if you can approach relationships that way, your communication skills are going to improve tremendously. And hopefully what will happen is that you will enjoy dealing even with cantankerous bosses and even with competitive co-workers. And not only are you going to enjoy this more, but presumably you are going to be much more successful at it. And having those two things in place, namely the variety in the job and the ability to communicate and achieve good relations with your superiors and subordinates and peers, having those two in place, the nature of work should improve tremendously. To see in more detail how the flow model would work in dealing with some of the typical problems on the job, let's review a few of the problems that we usually encounter at work and see what the flow theory can tell us about it and what kind of prescriptions for action it would suggest. For instance, if you are a manager, one of the things that you encounter quite often is that your workers are not living up to their potential. They don't seem to be motivated. They are not doing as well as you are sure they could be doing. When we try to motivate people, the stick and the carrot, the extrinsic motivators, are obviously well known to every manager. We know how to influence people's behavior by raises, by threats of firing, by the usual extrinsic means. But we don't have a very good idea of how to motivate people internally. That is, how to produce the kind of intrinsic rewards that flow produces on the job. And yet, if you succeed in doing that, you solve a lot of the motivational problems that you usually have. For instance, let's take the case of a subordinate you may have whom you think has potential, but it's not working up to it. What you would have to identify there is what is blocking the use of potential. Everyone is motivated to use their potential, so it's not that they don't want to use it. It's probably that there's something blocking it. And your job as a manager or superior is to find out what that block is and try to remove it. For some people, the block may be that they are working in an office they don't like. They don't have enough support. They don't have the secretarial or the material support that they need to feel really in control of the situation. You can find out what part of the situation is inhibiting this person from using their potential. Remember that generally the most important factor for motivation is being able to balance the challenges and the skills of your subordinates. It may be that the young person who is not living up to his or her potentials does it because they feel that you're not providing them with enough support to use their skills, or they feel that there is not enough challenge for them to work. And generally, if you are able to achieve that balance for your subordinate and make sure that they know exactly what they need to do, that is, their goals are clear, their skills are engaged with the right level of challenge, then their internal reward system will begin to kick in, and they will start working with much greater enthusiasm. In fact, this whole topic leads into another question, a related question, which is that of stress. Many of us feel that we are on the edge of burnout, that there is too much stress in our jobs. This situation has to be reconceptualized a certain way, which Flo helps us to understand, because we have to realize that stress is not an external factor. It's useful to think of the external causes of stress as strain. Now, we have a lot of strain in our jobs, but with the same amount of strain, one person may feel stressed and another may not feel stressed at all. He or she may feel challenged or involved in the job. So the stress is really our response to an external strain. And whether you are stressed or not is to a large extent dependent on your response to the external situation, and it's not really caused directly by the external situation. So the question of how you interpret the strain, how important it is for you to, for instance, perform at 120% or 100%, depending on what requirements are presented to you, that's your choice. And very often, the stress that we experience psychologically and that often has physical counterparts in illness and nervous breakdowns and so forth, very often this stress is not caused really by the external situation, but, for instance, by how self-conscious you are, how much on the line you feel every time you are given a job by your boss, every time you get a request. If in addition to the task that you are given, you are also burdening yourself with all kinds of expectations of failure or fear of not succeeding, of not being able to impress, to achieve, and worrying about how you will look when this thing is going to be carried through, when the task is finished. If you put too many of those burdens on you, then in addition to the external strain, you will feel the stress that is given by your expectations and by the attention you are devoting to these self-generated problems. Now, it's true, though, that there are times when the strain is too high and no one in his right mind would be able to take it without feeling stress. There are bosses who are unrealistic. There are times when every company has to work harder than usual, when there are economic situations where jobs get readjusted and new responsibilities get thrown on you. Under those conditions, it's not that you are putting stress on yourself, but you are given so much strain that you are really under stress, and there's nothing you can do with it. If you want to do the job, you will feel stressed. So at that point, you have to start taking an active role in redesigning the challenge that you are under. That means providing a good argument to your superiors that under these conditions you cannot continue working because of an impairment in the general productivity both of your unit, yourself, if these conditions continue. That will work especially if you have some alternatives. If you have thought about how to redesign the flow of challenges that comes to you or to your unit, and you can propose an alternative that will make, again, the balance between challenges and skills close enough so that you and your people can work with complete dedication and efficiency instead of feeling stressed. So there are no golden rules. There are no simple solutions. What is important is that in every condition, in every predicament on the job, you pay attention to the amount of challenges, to the potential skills, to the goals, and how these can be put together in a way that there is a harmonious response to the challenges rather than a feeling of being either bored and unchallenged or feeling that you have to work in fast forward to meet the demands that are put on you. If you pay attention, if you keep in mind the simple rules that make a flow experience possible, then you will be able to change many of the conditions that now produce tension and conflict into conditions that are harmonious and allow enjoyment to take place. One of the most interesting paradoxes and most puzzling findings in my research about optimal experience, about flow, has been that for most people, work is much closer to a flow experience than is their free time at home. This is true not only for surgeons or managers, but also for assembly line workers and clerical workers, because their jobs have more of the characteristic that flow activities have. For instance, in almost every job, there is some clarity as to what needs to be done, so the goals are clear. You do get feedback either from boss, co-workers, or from the nature of the job. You know when you did a job well. You have the satisfaction of even filing away things efficiently or typing a neat letter. So you get feedback from what you do. And the concentration is possible. You don't get as distracted as you may be at home when you have children and telephones ringing and a variety of conflicting things to do. For instance, we found that working women, when they are at work, they think at most about two things at the same moment. But when they are at home, they have to think about an average of seven different things. And so this kind of distraction, this kind of excessive and disparate demands on attention is more a characteristic of being out of the job than being on the job. So jobs do provide flow-like experiences for people. And yet the paradox is, the strange thing is that despite that fact, people would rather not work and would want to have more free time at home. Even though what they do at home lacks the positive quality of experience that work provides. Now, why is this happening? Well, as I hinted at before, a lot of the things we do at home have no structure. There are no demands, there are no clear goals, we don't get feedback for how well we are doing, the nature of the work tends to be repetitive. And so many people feel their energy level dropping, their interest dropping, their feeling of skills dropping as they go home. Now, in the past, this was not always true. In fact, typically, people did not make a sharp differentiation between work and leisure time. For instance, if you lived in a farming economy, which was typical of this country until 100 years ago, and it's still typical in much of the world now, in a farming economy, you went out, you did the tasks of milking the cows and sowing the grain on the field and working in the orchard, whatever you had to do, and then you came home And at home, instead of relaxing and watching television, what you did was you perhaps stitched a quilt or worked as a carpenter to make a new table. You may have been singing songs or working on a musical instrument. In fact, almost everybody played a musical instrument in the past, but now we don't need to. We figured that with stereo systems and television and videotapes, the entertainment is coming to us from outside. We don't have to provide it ourselves. And as a result of that, we are developing a very strangely passive leisure time. We have developed a kind of consumer orientation towards free time, which reduces the enjoyment that we have in our free time. So we created the space of freedom in which we don't know what to do. For many people, we find, as a result of our research, that the worst part of the week is Sunday morning between 10 and 12, roughly. By 10 o'clock, most people had had breakfast, read the papers, and if they haven't gone to church, then they have this block of time which is completely open and they don't know what to do with it. Their moods go down, they feel more and more depressed until about noon or 1 o'clock when they decide to do something, watch a TV program or go upstairs and clean the attic or mow the lawn or go visit a relative or whatever. Once the decision is made, the goal is focused again, you feel that you know what you want to do, and then you get yourself in gear, and the depression lifts. But until you know what you want to do, you feel depressed. And this is, to a less strong degree, this is what happens in free time in general. That is, we lack a structure, we lack goals, we lack the skills to amuse ourselves in a way that makes us feel that we are growing, that we are increasing in complexity. And therefore, the nature of free time tends to be strangely unproductive, unproductive of strong positive experience, of flow experience, and unproductive in terms of growth of skills. One of the dangers that people encounter when they start enjoying their job, though, is that the job can become somewhat addictive. You develop what nowadays is called workaholism. In other words, all you can do is work and nothing else interests you anymore. This is a real danger. It's a danger of any flow activity can become addictive if that's the only way you can experience flow. So the cure for that is to diversify. The cure for it is not to become specialized, not to respond to only one set of challenges, not to develop only one set of skills. The problem of workaholism is that as you enjoy your job more and more, you derive less and less enjoyment from your free time, from being with your family. You neglect other responsibilities, you neglect your family. You don't realize how many other ways to enjoy yourself there are, and so you become too dependent on the one single enjoyment. Now, the danger in this is that sooner or later, you may have to retire. Most jobs have a limit as to how long you can perform them. Even surgery does. You become too old to wield your instruments with the precision required. And so now you are out of the game that provided enjoyment for you. There's nothing more to do, and you haven't developed the skills to enjoy anything else. And that is a dangerous time. It's a dangerous time when you approach retirement if the only skills you had were focused on your job. So the way to make sure that you can experience flow in your life for as long as possible and in as many different ways as possible is to begin to diversify as soon as possible and begin to enjoy family life, begin to enjoy the community responsibilities or challenges, to improve your local hospital, to improve the school system, and make sure that the political system is working well. All of these can provide enjoyable challenges, And as you begin to learn the skills to deal with them, you will be prepared in case retirement is approaching, or even before that, to take on the opportunities for enjoyment outside of your job.
A woman named Dorothy recalls how she was able to find enjoyment in solitude.
I moved to this tiny island in northern Minnesota so that I could find peace and solitude. After my husband died and my children grew up, I decided it was the best place to be. It feels just like home. I have flower tubs, garden gnomes, signs with poetry or rhymes or corny jokes on all my trees, and indoors I keep a lot of my favorite items. Every day I follow my schedule. Wake up by 5 o'clock, check the hens for eggs, milk the goat, split some wood, make breakfast, wash, sew, fish, and so on. In the evenings I usually read and write. Although I get occasional visits from fishermen passing through, most of my time is spent alone. I don't mind it. I keep myself busy.
Finding flow in your relationships can be one of the most fulfilling aspects of your life. This side addresses creating this optimal experience in your relationship with yourself and with others.
When Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, was asked what a person should do to be happy, he answered, "Work and love." It is true that work and relationships with other people are the two main planks of adult life. They take up most of our time, and they can produce the worst aggravations as well as the deepest joys. Therefore, our life can be vastly improved if we apply the principles of flow to our relationships. First of all, to improve the quality of life, it is important that we learn to live with ourselves. On the average, people in our society spend about one-third of their waking time by themselves, and this part of the day is often the worst. Most people feel very lonely when they have to be alone, left to their own devices. The depression you may experience in solitude is often what drives people to drink or to drugs. But if you can learn to control your consciousness in solitude, a great number of potentially exciting activities becomes possible. Similarly, relations with other people, which are often the source of friction and conflict, can be modified so that they help happiness instead of inhibiting it. Family life, friendships, and even occasional interactions at parties can be extremely enjoyable if lived in terms of the principles of flow.
Flow and solitude.
First of all, it's useful to think about what you do when you're alone. Most people spend between 20 and 40% of their waking time alone. Again, for most people, every dimension of the quality of experience gets worse when they are alone. They are more sad, more passive, more depressed. They have lower self-esteem. They feel duller and less involved when alone. Is this true of you too? Is this how you feel when you're alone, or do you know how you can control your consciousness, mobilize your energy so that you can do things like plan for the future, visualize what you will be doing next day on the job or when you are with your friends? Can you meditate? Do you have a hobby? Do you have some kind of artistic activity, like painting or writing, that you can do so that you don't need to depend completely on external stimulation to become mentally engaged? Unfortunately, most people, when they come home after a day on the job, they feel that they are too exhausted to do anything constructive, to do anything that really produces flow in their lives. So the easy way that we often take is to simply plop down on the sofa and turn on television. This is one of the ways we have learned to take the edge of depression off our mind, and it's certainly one of the easiest. But unfortunately, watching television, for instance, is not a solution that really works for a long period. For most people, when they watch TV, they feel just a bit better than what they do when they have nothing else to do. They still feel, though, passive, depressed. They still have a low self-esteem. They still feel dull instead of creative, because